Serve me that much food again.
Not that far away, mate. I'm actually in Sydney.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, we've pulled off a miracle. Mary and I have driven up from the farm to Sydney, and we've met Julie, who's driven from Calypso Bay down to Sydney. So we've just had a celebration meet-up dinner, and we'll be doing filming for the next few days and then back down to the farm. Julie's going to come with us, so we'll have a bit of an adventure down there. First time I've actually been able to give Jules a cuddle for 63 days.
Glad you were counting. Really.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to be important.
Yeah. Right. Cool. So you've got your technical advisor and manipulator. Well done.
Yeah. Awesome. Incredible. G'day, Renee Curran.
Oops.
Hello, Renee.
Hello, how are you?
Ah, good, mate, good. I hear you've been crook today.
A little bit, yep. And Pete's here as well.
Hi, hey, Pete.
Hey, mate, how you going?
Yeah, good, good. Can't wait to talk to you guys at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Yeah, if tonight goes like last night, we'll still be awake. So it'll be good. We're looking forward to it.
Oh, crikey. Yeah, tough night.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah, it happens. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Along with three kids.
Yep.
But where you got your three kids are all under the age of what?
Eight.
Under the age of eight, yeah. So there you go. That's a mouthful. Timmy Devereaux is lining up for it. So I don't know if you can see Timmy's name on the list, but we go back a fair way with Tim, and I think he's got two or about to have. Tim, is your second one delivered yet?
No, not yet, but the missus is very clucky.
Very clucky. And the first one is what, three?
Yeah, three going on 15.
Yeah. We have a 3.5-year-old granddaughter, mate, and yeah, same story. Same story. Yeah,
flat biscuit.
Yeah, I reckon.
Tim, feel free to send your wife to our house for a week, and I reckon that'll put the brakes on the cluckiness.
I'd be up for that.
Yeah, I don't know, Pete. She's like a couple of weeks away from delivering, so you would end up with four in the house, four kids. Yeah, you hear that? Do you hear that sound, everybody? That's the sound of someone who just cracked.
And just cracked because I've got two of them sitting right on my lap.
I thought I heard some baby noises.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway,
they might learn something.
You never know, mate. Depends whether they're listening or not.
Yeah.
And whether they understand. So I will keep my swear words to a minimum, and we're going to start on account of it's a minute or two past. And it's actually Peter and Renee who first put me onto this idea of webinars are better when you start and finish when you say you would. So that's enough for mucking around. We're going to get going. Pardon me. So the purpose of tonight is to go over what we did on Saturday. And so it's an interesting thing to see how you can put a 4-hour gig into a 1-hour session. Generally, we can do it, but we've got to go like blazes. So I'm just going to talk like crazy and then we'll do questions at the end. If you were there on Saturday, I know Michael was, I'm not too sure about the rest of you. This is kind of like completely different in character, yet it's exactly the same set of slides. So we won't bother with every single slide where we talked about, you know, because we were starting on the hour, every hour, on Saturday, then we were taking 15-minute breaks. You don't need to know that. But what you do need to have covered is this whole concept of we are taught that someone else makes us happy. And that's obviously a myth, but it's not obvious until you actually look at it and go, hang on, it's actually me who makes me happy. I'm the one who makes the decisions. And people who try to make me happy or people who try to make me unhappy, they will fail miserably because it's all up to me. So that's a myth of relationships, is that most people expect that they're going to be happier in relationships because relationships start because we like the person that we get in relationships with. But essentially what happens is we get together, and I told the story of Jack and Jane. And we bring a whole bunch of emotional needs into the relationship with us. But we don't know about these emotional needs ourselves, let alone does our partner have any idea about them. So, pardon me. So I told the story of Jane who essentially that her early life leaves her feeling powerless. And as a consequence of that, she grows up feeling like, you know, because her mother's a bit of a tyrant and her dad, you know, kind of just lets things go. And her older brother just gets out of there, then basically what happens is that she ends up on alone, all alone, and she fills the emotional void in her life by imagining and daydreaming about having beautiful things and having a man who will stand up for her because a father never did and a brother never did either. And so essentially her hidden emotional need is for people to take care of her because she learned that she couldn't take care of herself because she was victimized by a mother and a father and a brother never stood up for her. So she becomes what we call in the vernacular a princess. What I want to do is stop and say, I'm not saying all princesses are women. Lots of you will know a bloke who's a princess. And basically it's someone who kind of keeps just messing up because the deep-seated feelings of powerlessness within them are never fixed and they never get to be powerful in their life and make things the way they want them to be. So Jane the princess grows up and finds herself a hero. Let's call him Jack. And Jack is everything that she's been looking for all of her life. He's just typically one of those blokes who just gets on with it. And he happens to be, as a consequence of the way things were in his life, he's capable and he's opinionated and he's, you know, willing to just have a go at anything and won't accept failure as an option. And he's strong and he speaks his mind and he doesn't care who agrees with him or doesn't agree with him. And in the princess, he finds somebody that he can provide for. And so he goes and he solves all of her problems powerfully and decisively. And he does that because that's his thing. In other words, he has the same feelings of powerlessness that she had, but his reaction to it is different. And so he gets out there and smashes the world into shape, whereas she gets bashed around by the world, essentially for the same reasons, but different reactions to what's going on. So they get together and they're happy for a while because he's happy because there's always something to be fixing, and she's happy because he's fixing everything that goes wrong. And so things go on for a while. But after a period of time, and it could be 5 years or 25 years, what happens is that Jane suddenly starts to explode with rage whilst Jack is fixing something. And she explodes with rage because what's going on is that Jack fixing it is reminding her that she messed it up in the first place. So this doesn't happen early on, but after a while it does. It's kind of like when you first get together with someone, you don't notice that they squeeze a toothpaste tube in the middle, but after a couple of years, it starts driving you nuts. So Jane just gets cranky, and she gets cranky because Jack fixing it makes her or reminds her that she cocked it up in the first place and that she's a bit of a dope and whatever. At the same time, what's going on is Jack is starting to get sick of having to fix things and wants to know why she keeps messing things up. And in the middle of fixing something that, you know, leaves him frustrated, he starts calling her the very things that her mother called her. So in this case, underperformer and hopeless or whatever. And so what happens is Jane is now experiencing her childhood again, and Jack is experiencing his childhood again, because it doesn't matter how hard he works, he still can't get it right. And so neither of them, because now they're having blues all the time, neither of them can actually work out where things went wrong and how come this person that I loved and adored is now someone that just drives me nuts. So the hidden agenda comes from, as I mentioned, this common agenda. In other words, I see in my work all the time people who look different on the surface, but underneath they're the same. So the underneath bit is that they feel powerless for whatever reason. Most of the people who fit in the Jack category had similar kind of backgrounds to the Jill category, in as much as it was all difficult. It was all kind of like, you know, they just get left feeling like, you know, there was nothing in their control. So that's all it is that their reaction is different. And so because they have a different reaction to it, but they have the same bottom line belief, then they clash. And the reason they clash is because they think that the other one shouldn't be like they are. They don't understand why. And, you know, they battle with it. And really what's going on is that Jack gets what he wants in life by pushing life into shape. He's one of those people who doesn't mind being aggressive, doesn't mind using force or willpower, and is prepared to work his backside off. Meanwhile, what he notices is Jane gets what she wants by being manipulative and subverting people and subverting things and, you know, under the surface, you know, kind of being a bit of a manipulator. So that strikes him as a bit ugly. Of course, it strikes her that he's a bit ugly. So when you look at it, they've both ended up back where they were, and now they're in trouble because the strategy of Hero and Princess, whilst it delivered in the beginning, doesn't really work long time. Because you see, those strategies don't work because they're working against something. They're working against feeling powerless. And the funny thing about that is that you can't be working against something if it's not there. So when we see people struggling to be powerful or being overly powerful or whichever version of it that you see, the reality is that they're actually experiencing the opposite at a deep down inner level, and that's a reason that they're working against it. So many people are actually the opposite of what you see them displaying. And that gets to be an issue in relationships because, you see, what happens is that these strategies are actually making the feelings of powerlessness more, because the more Jack does for Jane, the more powerless she feels because she always needs him to fix it up. And of course, the more that she messes it up, then the more he feels like he has to fix it. And so what happens is that they just get messed up. But if they were to both personally, separately focus on their internal stuff, then those strategies would be quickly abandoned. In other words, if they look for solutions within themselves instead of in their world around them, then they would find that they would have a breakthrough. And that's what most people never do. If we take them back to how they did this, well, they learned. They initially work hard at doing that. So Jack works hard at being a strong, capable character. Jane works hard at figuring out how to be hopeless and be a damsel in distress and cry for help. And when they get it right, when they do that, and it's not necessarily easy to do when they're 6 or 10 years old, but when they do it, their feelings of powerlessness go away. And because the feelings of powerlessness go away, they feel happy. They feel like it's good. So therefore, everything looks like it's working. And so Jack comes to the conclusion that only an idiot wouldn't be a pushy bastard. And Jane comes to the conclusion that, you know, there's just no way that she's ever going to get what she wants without help. And so it's all working fine. But what happens is over a period of time, those attitudes and reactions and beliefs and strategies and all of that, they become second nature, or what you and I would call habitual. And now we've got a problem, because what we mean by habitual is that they start saying, "It's just the way I am. It's just how I turned out. I'm just not the kind of person who could do this or that or the other. I'm the person who da 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 da. I've always been that way. It's been that way forever and a day. Every time I try and change it, I come back to how I was, blah, 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 blah." And you'll hear those fateful words, "It's just the way I am." And when you hear somebody saying, "It's just the way I am," what you're doing is you're listening to someone who's decided that they're stuck and it's okay. So what they do is they start to rationalize it. They start to talk about, you know, "But it's not so bad. Imagine if I was the opposite, and that would be hopeless. And what's wrong with being how I am anyway? And oh God, look at everybody else, and it doesn't work for them, and that's all ugly," and blah, 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 blah. So what happens is, regardless of your spiritual beliefs, whether we call it God or the universe, but what happens is they get attracted to each other. And this is God or the universe's way of helping them to fix it, because they get attracted because their needs are fulfilled, because Jane's got someone who can fix everything and Jack's got someone who creates enough disasters so that he's constantly busy. And because he's constantly busy fixing stuff, he feels good and he feels useful and productive, and, you know, everything's great from that point of view. The trouble is, when they are meeting each other's needs like this, what happens is they get imprisoned for life, because Jane can't break out, and of course Jack can't break out either because their partner wouldn't cope. So what happens is what they don't realise is what's here in this orange text, and that is, if we are going to make it, what we have to do is we have to confront our own inner feelings of inadequacy. We have to go there and we have to feel the truth of our inadequacy, because if we don't, then we won't feel those emotions thoroughly enough to process them, to have them dissipate through our system. In other words, most people who feel undeserving work against it, try and stop that feeling, try and tell themselves, no, but I am a good person. Oh yeah, but really I'm not. And so these deep convictions of unworthiness, or whatever it is, untrustworthiness or undeservability, whatever they are, we don't go there and fully experience them because they're so ugly. And, you know, it seems ludicrous that we'd say, look, go and feel it a bit more and it'll be okay. We feel like, well, that would be just diving into it, and that would be an abyss that I would never come out of. And, you know, most people with deep feelings of sadness think, if I go in there, I'm going to drown. I'll never get out. So who would go there? So we're not taught that this could be a good idea. In fact, we're taught that this is probably the worst idea on the planet. And anybody proposing this idea is probably some kind of nutcase, because it doesn't make sense to us. So we don't go deep inside. What we do is we keep working at this system that kind of prolongs the inevitable. So these people become codependent. And if we're going to break out of that, we have to become aware of the hidden agenda that we bring into the relationship. If we don't do that, then we can't remove the burden from our partner. In other words, Jack is saying to Jane, make me feel good. Jane is saying to Jack, make me feel good. If we don't take that burden off our partner, then obviously that burden is felt by our partner, and you will find your partner, if you've ever been in this situation, you'll be saying to your partner, or your partner will be saying to you, it doesn't seem to matter what I do, I can't get it right. Now, the reason why that they're saying that, whether you're saying it or your partner's saying it, is that we are trying to fix something we can't fix. We're trying to fix a need in our partner instead of helping our partner fix that need for themselves. And we feel like there's an endless list of things we have to do to get it right. We do all of those things, and then one thing goes wrong, and it's kind of like then we just get overcome with this overwhelming feelings of, it doesn't matter how hard I try, I don't seem to be able to make you happy. Or it doesn't matter how hard I try, you never seem to be happy, or you seem to be determined not to be happy, or whatever I do is not good enough. That's actually the hidden agenda manifesting itself. So the reality is, what I'm saying is, Jane has to go where she doesn't want to. Jane has to go and confront her feelings of weak and powerlessness and being trampled on by the world and unable to make things happen. And as I said to a client this afternoon, not less than 2 hours ago, I said to a client, you have to go and sit in a quiet room and face the fact that you don't know the answer. And she said, I couldn't do that. I said, well, until you do, you're never going to be free of this. At the same time that she needs to explore those feelings of powerlessness that she thinks is actually just a fundamental problem of hers that's never going to go away, Jack needs to let her do that, because what that's going to do is bring up his feelings of, I can't fix her, and that's my job, is to help the people that I love. And no matter how hard I can, I work, I can't do it. So now I'm just relegated to being helpless and watching her do that and feeling helpless myself. And between them, they could work their way through that, particularly if they're prepared to share that thing. I see this in my work as a number one problem in relationships, commonly referred to by the psychologists as codependence. And that is, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. We'll make each other feel like shit, and we'll make each other feel like good, and we'll put the blame on each other for everything that goes wrong, and it'll just turn out to be a disaster. It's why the divorce rate is 2 out of 3. So, you know, if you remain in a long-term relationship, then obviously you've got something going for you. You just need to hear some of these tricks. Because you see, effectively, what we say to our partners is, it is your job to make me feel valued and loved. It is your job to make me feel safe and secure. It is your job to make me feel connected to you or to my spiritual world or whatever it is that I want to feel connected to. When you think about it, this is 100% horseshit. This is 100% bad, 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 bad. Because Nobody can make you feel valued and loved. You know yourself that you value and love someone who does not hear it. That, you know, you express this love and value towards them and it's like it bounces off. And the reason behind that is that you cannot make them feel that. They have to feel that. So these are the three big ones. The psychologists tell us that in relationship, these are the three big emotional needs that we most want sorted out. And so what we have to do is we have to work on having status with ourselves. You see, status is kind of like feeling valued and loved. If I have importance in my own life, if what I want matters, if what I want cares, I have status with myself. If I take myself into my spiritual beliefs on a regular basis, I have connection with myself. And if I understand that I'm all that I've got and there's no one coming to save me, then I have security within myself. We can look at these things and see that what most people do is they search for these things on the outside. And so status comes with a big house or a flash car or whatever it is, you know, whatever we think is going to give us status. Connection comes from having lots of friends and security. Maybe that's a lot of money or whatever it is. So all of those things are external and none of those things can actually work because it doesn't matter how many Porsches you've got. In fact, I was looking at a car collection this afternoon that was $31 million worth of motor cars and the dude's looking for another car. So what you'll see is that there's nothing on the outside and no amount of stuff on the outside can ever fix anything on the inside, can ever fix a hole or a gap on the inside. It is absolute sheer ludicrousness to expect that your partner could do that, but that's what we say to them every day is that's what I want you to do for me. And when in actual fact, it's what we need to do for ourselves. So we summarize that first session. This was the first 45 minutes in the day by saying, if you don't learn to satisfy your own emotional needs, then you remain incomplete and you remain dependent on your partner. And sooner or later, your partner's going to get the shits with that. And then you get to be on your own to fix it anyway. So you either fix this on your own now or sometime in the future. We then took a break and we came back and we looked at how we get into trouble. And basically, one of the things we need to understand is that when I decide that I need something, whether that's a new car or a new house or a new partner or whatever, whenever I decide that I need something, whether it's for Mary to tell me she loves me or whether it's something else, then the pursuit of it easily turns obsessive and compulsive and addictive and the need becomes greater and greater, even though it actually hasn't. In other words, what I'm saying is when I decide that I need something, it grows in my mind. The neediness for it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. It does not go away. It actually grows because of my focus on it. It's an interesting concept because what it means is that the need itself increases the emotional intensity and the perception of the need. In other words, just by thinking about it, it grows in my head and it becomes this dominating thing. And therefore, the more I think about what, you know, you should do for me, then the stronger my need for you to do that becomes to me. And the more painful it is when you don't, and the more I start to obsess on it, goes round and round in circles. So therefore, if you understand that, then what you'll see is, you know, we just need to change the focus onto what I need to do for me, and then I can obsess about that. There are signs that your emotional needs are not being met. So I'm not saying that you need to fully 100% meet your own emotional needs and you should not need anybody else. What I'm suggesting is that you first of all start with you. When you feel like it's not working, when you feel like your emotional needs are not being met, then what happens is affection vanishes. This is why people say to you, love and romance disappear. That they just tend to kind of walk out the back door one day when no one was watching. That coincides with, one of the contributing things to this is communication seems to have dropped off to a minimum, that, you know, communication turns out to be sort of just, you know, whatever we need to get by. And then there's feelings of resentment start to show up. And that is, you know, like we don't have enough money to go around, but it looks like you get more of the toys than I do. Or more of the things that you want than I do, or we don't have enough time, it looks like you get more time off than I do, or, you know, we work hard, but it looks like I'm working harder than you work, so the resentments show up. And, of course, what happens then is we start to avoid each other because being with each other brings up or reminds us of what's not there. We start daydreaming about how we want it to be, We start imagining that it could be different, and we will even talk to somebody else other than our partner about the difficulties we're finding in the relationship. Much of this is good-hearted confiding in someone. It's kind of like searching for help. It's kind of like, oh, I don't know, mate, have you got any ideas? I'm just working my fingers to the bone. Doesn't seem to be enough. Can never make him or her happy, blah, 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 blah. And we start to talk to people who cannot in any way help us because they're not in the relationship. So it's important to have a look at why we don't get to fix that trouble. And the real reason is that most people, if they were given a choice, would avoid conflict. Like, who would go into an argument as opposed to no argument? Really, that's kind of like a given. So we will avoid conflict if we can, which means that anything that's difficult in the relationship gets put off until sometime in the future when we're all not so tired or not so overworked or we've all got a bit more time or a bit more money or when this current pressure is off. You know, let's talk about this when we've got the kids in school. Let's talk about this when, you know, we're on holiday or blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, what happens is that the issues that we're not talking about fester and grow. And what I mean by fester and grow is actually get worse. And this is an interesting concept because what it means is that they don't get better. We assume that these things are going to heal themselves for some reason, but of course they don't. And as they fester, then what happens is the whole thing gets like a volcano ready to erupt. And so then some random event happens. It might be a car smash. It might be a kid being sick. It could be one of the pair of you overstressed or overworked or whatever it is. And then so some random event happens. It could be the toothpaste tube being squeezed in the middle. There's any number of, you know, trivial events that can take place. And an explosion happens and you're all familiar with that. So that heat, I call it heat, it's the angry, you know, explosive kind of, I don't know what to do thing, that prevents a solution from happening because at this stage we lose all reasonableness. The concept of being reasonable just goes out the window. And so what happens is we get the standoff or the walk off, and that's, you know, like, I can't deal with you. I've got to go to work anyway. And away we go. The standoff is kind of like some kind of agreement that we're not solving this, but, you know, we don't know what to do either. As a consequence of the standoff, the heat goes out of it and things kind of drift back to normal, except they're not quite normal. There's still this kind of hurt and anger and separation. And basically any confiding in each other about how difficult this is actually gets expressed to somebody else, a friend or whoever. And of course that person can't fix it because they're not in the relationship. The problem is that, you know, that gets us nowhere because it's rare that the friend has any professional experience to help us with. When it comes to fixing trouble, basically what we have to face is at some point we have to compassionately sit down and tell the truth to our partner as we're experiencing it without expecting them to agree that our view is actually the truth. But we need to express how we feel and what we see going on compassionately, not forcefully, compassionately. We all need gentleness and kindness in our life, not force and will. When you look at it, really, it doesn't take any talent. And in fact, a complete absence of courage is all it needs for you to be whinging and bitching and moaning and complaining to other people, which, by the way, tells them more about you than it does about your partner. So you could be whinging about your partner as the worst person in the world. You're actually telling your mate or your friend that you can't even communicate with them, that you have run out of skills, run out of ability, and that you've reached a point of hopelessness and that all you're doing is whinging. So it does anything except fix it. When it comes to fixing it, we look at what we've got to do. I reckon there are three phases to a heart-to-heart with your partner. Interestingly enough, these things were not difficult when you first got together. And if you look at relationships and how they begin, then what happens is we open our hearts and we talk endlessly. And when I ask in relationships courses, what do all couples do when they first get together? People, you know, constantly reply with lots of sex. And I go, yeah, sure, fair enough. But there is something that happens more than that, and it is talking. Just open-hearted sharing of our dreams and our hopes and aspirations and what we feel about things. You know, the reason people get into a relationship is that they can connect with each other over a period of time. That's what goes out of the relationship, is willingness and the desire to connect even when it's difficult. So to fix things, to have this, what I'm talking about, compassionate confrontation, then we need to do three things. And those three things mean we need to set it up. Then we need to know what to do when we're talking about this stuff. And then we need to find a new place. The steps in that basically mean that we have to agree about when it is we're going to be talking, and what the location is and what the purpose of the conversation is. This is not the conversation. This is the conversation about the conversation. This is the kind of like the setup, as I say. The other part that's critically ingredient is that we need to have this agreement that we're going to stay in this confrontational, compassionate confrontational, we're going to stay in the difficult place until we both feel heard, until we both get to a better position than the one that we started in, or the one that created the thing in the first place. In other words, you know, Mary and I realized this was a fundamental thing in our lives. Neither of us knew about how to do this. We both came from families where arguments resulted in people storming off and standoffs and stonewalling and all that sort of stuff. And we realized what we had to do is we had to demonstrate to our children that we could clash, that we could have a different opinion, but that we could protect each other in that difference of opinion, that we could take care of each other in an argument, that we could look after each other, and we could stay in the argument long enough to get to the point where both of us are in a better position than when we started. That is a high level commitment that most people are not willing to do, because sooner or later the situation gets hot enough that it gets ugly and we're unwilling to sit in the ugliness of it, and somebody storms off and ruins the whole thing. So none of this stuff is going to work without point two being written in concrete. Having established that, then what we need to do is make part of the setup is that if it does get heated up, we have to sit there and take a break or take a walk or whatever and calm down, because we're not going to solve this thing. If it's that difficult, we're not going to solve it with heat. We're going to solve it by being rational and by being calm and by being kind and by realizing we're talking to our life partner here, not some person who we're ready to kill. Then what we have to do is address one issue at a time. That means saying things like, when you do X, I feel Y. That's a pretty straightforward thing, and I will deal with this in more depth later. You have to be responsible for your part in it and own up to your bit in it. And then you have to say what you want. You have to share that time together. You have to kind of, you've got to get to the point where you're addressing what is going on emotionally. Because if you don't talk about the emotional injuries that are happening, then they're not getting healed. It is not your partner's job to heal your emotional injuries. It's your partner's job to hear them out and to listen to you and to empathize with you, as long as you are doing the same to them. And then finally, what we have to do is commit to something new, because unless we agree to do it different, we're not doing it different. We're doing it the same. And if you do the same, you're going to get the same. So unless we're committing to something new, then the whole thing's been wasted. So that's our formula. I'm going to come back to some parts of that in a little bit more depth. It's pioneered by the work done by John Gottman in his Love Lab, which I'm going to recommend that you have a look at his work on YouTube. I'll refer to some more of his, but basically what we need to do is have a look at the list of your emotional needs in your primary relationship. In other words, what do you need in your primary relationship? I'm going to suggest to you that they are primarily status, connection, and security, but they are going to come from you. You get them from your partner as long as you are giving them to your partner. So that's kind of an interesting thing. So really, the questions for you are these needs. Once you identify what these needs are, in addition to the three that I just mentioned, then are they being met by you, and are they being met by your partner? And as a consequence of those questions, what changes do you need to make? Because if you're not going to make some changes, then you're going to keep doing the same. And if you keep doing the same, you're going to get the same. So that completed our second session. We then went on to, after that second break, to have a look at how we do this formula for resolution of pain in more depth. And so the key thing is start slowly. Really what we mean here is that when a conversation starts gently and you communicate, you take the time to communicate respect, both partners feel much more positive about themselves and the relationship itself, which means that there's a good chance we can find some resolution, we can make some progress. So how do we do that? How do we make sure that this is going to work well? Well, the first thing you have to do is take responsibility for your part in it. In other words, I probably have contributed to this. I take some responsibility in this from the point of view of I've said this, done that, I haven't this, I haven't the other, I've done too much of this, I've done too much of that, I didn't do this well, I didn't do it enough, I left it undone, I forgot, or whatever it is. So it's really important that you own up to your part in the whole story. Otherwise, your partner is going to be looking for some way of getting you to take that responsibility, when it would be a whole lot better for both of you if you took responsibility for your part in it. Then go on to state a positive need. And that's like, here's how I feel about blah, 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 and here's what I need to happen next time around. So it's kind of like, you know, I feel frustrated that da, 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 da. What I need is to get to a solution, blah, 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 blah. So that's pretty sure that, in other words, stated as a positive need. I'll give you a classic example from my own life. You know, I can say, look, Mary, I feel like you take 1,000 words when 10 would do, and could you stop telling long stories that are endless details that I don't care about? Or I could say, I feel frustrated that you don't get to the point. What I need is for you to cut to the chase. In other words, make sure it's a positive need rather than what you don't need. That's really helpful, because then Mary can go to town and figure out, okay, is cutting to the chase something that she can do? Is it something she's willing to do? Is it something that's fair? All of that sort of stuff. And we can start to talk about the real truth of what we're doing and how it works and whether we can make that work. Next thing is to use I statements. I statements are important because what they do is they allow you to be responsible for how you feel in the circumstances and the situation. They're less critical, and they, you know, when we start with you do this and you don't do that and you do too much of this, the accusatory part of it is what makes people defensive, and there's no need for that. So that allows us to describe what's happening. In other words, when this happens, here's what I feel. It allows you to stay out of judging and blaming. And it means that what you can do is you can say what you're seeing and hearing rather than saying what you think is making your partner do that. Because if you can just make the observation, then we can just... it can be neutral. It doesn't have to be blaming or accusatory or any of those kind of things. But if you choose to stay polite during the conversation, what you do is you keep the heat out of it. And if you're being polite and being respectful, I think that that's a bare minimum. You know, we tend to argue and we tend to be, you know, call our partners names and talk about their motivation being ugly, and we say nasty things, when in actual fact, if there's anybody who deserves some politeness, it's your partner, because they stuck with you for this long. And what most of us don't realize is, if there's anybody who deserves a second chance, if there's anybody who deserves politeness and kindness in the face of their own bad behavior, it's your partner, because they've been with you for this long. So they've earned it. And I think that ought to be obvious, but quite often it's not. You know, we say, you know, if you spoke to your friends the way you speak to your partner, you'd have no friends. Maybe we should take that on board a little bit more often. While we're on that subject, what we're saying is, you know, what you need to do is be appreciative. It's really important that you clearly state your appreciation of whatever your partner is making an effort on, or what they're struggling with, or what they're trying their best to do and failing with. It's really important that you appreciate what is working, because when you do that, you'll find there is quite a lot of it in terms of their effort. But this stuff works a whole lot better if you deal with it when it's small. So, you know, one of our master coaches used to say, nip it in the bud, get to it before it gets big. Bottling it up is just going to turn it into something ugly, and it's going to be an explosion. And that explosion is actually created by a lack of courage. It's actually exploded by, look, I don't want to deal with it, it could turn ugly. Let it go, you know, maybe it'll go away. That's actually a lack of courage. We need to kind of speak up early, because then we can speak up early when it's small. And we can even start by saying, look, this is just a little thing, but it's important to me because of our relationship. So it's important we do that, because when things build up and they become too much to take, that's what we call flooding. And flooding is a technical term that we need to describe. Flooding is a really important thing to understand. It's in psychological terms, it's measured in the heart, in the rise in heart rate. And so what we see is that if for somebody to be flooded, what we know is that their heart rate's going to hit 100 beats a minute. This is what is normally experienced when somebody is in rage or in tears or whatever. And so what happens when we hit about 100 beats per minute, depending on your own personal physical fitness, then what happens is your body starts pumping adrenaline and a bunch of other hormones in that overemphasize and keep the distress high for long periods of time, much longer than is relevant to the situation. Now, we can measure this stuff, not Mary and I, but we've done the studies on this stuff with other people. We read the research, and basically emotional hijacking is apparent from that heart rate thing. The heart rate, when this happens, when flooding happens, the heart rate will jump 10, 20, or even as many as 30 beats a minute within the space of one or two heartbeats. What that means is this is like instant. This is like absolute like flash flood. Now, what goes along with that is muscles get tense, breathing goes berserk. We get swamped in toxic feelings that really feel like, you know, we're just drowning in the whole thing and we can't escape it. And that logic and reason just doesn't matter anymore, because our feelings are so powerful. And those subjective feelings take over and they just kind of seem to sit there forever and ever. So at this point, it's just, there's no hope of being reasonable. There's no point of seeing the other person's point of view. There's no hope of getting unconfused, because confusion turns up. The whole thing really goes bad at this point. And what it is kind of like, it's too much to cope. My bucket is full and there's more that I can cope with. The reality is, for all their strength and toughness, the reality is that men are much more prone to flooding than women. So as emotional intensity moves up, then men lose it before women do. That's probably got to do with women handling more garbage because of being mothers and all that sort of stuff. But what happens is once they're flooded, then they secrete more adrenaline into their bloodstream, and that adrenaline is triggered by lower levels of negativity on their partner's point. In other words, the adrenaline gets triggered by lower and lower levels of the partner's so-called bad behavior or words or whatever. And it takes men longer to get over it physiologically than it does for women. That's partly because of the higher levels of adrenaline, those kind of things, and the less number of skills for reducing that adrenaline. So that's why men want to avoid conflict, right? So that they tend to protect themselves by what we call stonewalling. And when they do, that actually drops their heart rate. So they can subjectively say to you, I feel a bit better. It's a subjective measurement because, you know, the heart rate is still, you know, way up to speed. The trouble is when men stonewall, women think that they're being abandoned, and so their heart rate shoots up through the roof and they go into higher levels of distress. So what that boils down to is men want to avoid emotional confrontations and women feel compelled to go and seek them out, which is kind of like where we get the opposites, right? So he's trying to avoid the big deal and she's trying to make the big deal happen. And that's where things start to come unraveled, is they just don't understand each other. So just as men are much more likely to be stonewallers, women are much more likely to criticize their partners for being stonewallers and saying, you know, get some courage and come out here, grow a pair and engage and blah, 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 blah. So what do we do? Well, what we have to do is we have to invest in our emotional bank account a long time before we need to. So this is the reason we talk about a bank account. This is the same as creating long-term financial future. If you've got a bank account that you stick money in over a long period of time, because of compounding interest, that turns out to be a spectacularly great result. So what do we mean by an emotional bank account? Well, it's actually just kind of like a comparison thing that describes how much trust has been built up in a relationship, how close we feel, or how safe you feel with your partner or another human being. So John Gottman was not the inventor of the expression. It was coined by Stephen Covey. But Gottman identified the fact that what we need to do is we need to work on this 5-to-1 ratio. And what he says is any act of turning towards your partner, no matter how small or subtle, is a positive interaction. So he measured positive interactions and he said he measured negative interactions. But the way he categorized them was you either turn towards your partner or you turn away. In other words, you open up or you close up. And he called those two things positive and negative. And he said the situation boils down to you need a 5-to-1 ratio. 5 positives equals 1 negative. So you can say one bad thing to your partner and then apologize and say, okay, well, I evened it up. It's 1-for-1. Gottman's research points out 1-for-1 is a highly toxic negative situation. 2-for-1 is still highly toxic, very negative situation. That is not until you get to 5-to-1 that you're going to see an evenness, that things are back to level. So he said there were 3 keys to managing the emotional bank account. And the first was that to be satisfied in the relationship, couples have to focus on keeping on depositing, keeping on making positive interactions and minimizing the things that they know create negative interactions because they've either been told or they've observed about those things. He said, especially in conflict, you need the 5-to-1 ratio to just get back to neutral. But that in everyday life, the actual ratio is about 20 positives to 1 negative. In other words, we need to be thinking constantly about how do I surprise and delight my partner. This comes down to a basic philosophical attitude about are you wandering around saying to yourself, how do I surprise and delight my partner? Or are you wandering around saying, how do I get through the day? Because if it's how do I get through the day, the chances are your partner's going to feel like they come second to that. And many people feel like they come second, third, or fourth to the business, the kids, the whatever's going on, simply because we're just in survival mode. So Gottman came up with what he called the 4 horsemen. And in his love labs, where they're studying couples and how they interact over things like breakfast, etc., he said that basically what happens is that where there is criticism, then the relationship is going downhill. And what he meant by that is verbally attacking either personality or character or what, that kind of stuff. He said the antidote to that is a gentle startup, is finding something positive to say in the beginning, like, you know, thank you for being in my life. Thank you for turning up today. Thank you for wanting to have kids with me or whatever it is. He said the second horseman, he called them the 4 horsemen because they're the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse, of the 4 things that are going to kill your relationship. He said the second big one, the major turning point was contempt. It's where we've made a judgment about our partner being fundamentally flawed and that we hold them in contempt for that, that our attitude towards them is insulting and that, you know, we say things that are meant to hurt. And of course, he said the opposite of that, the thing that will make it come undone, the thing that will stop that from happening is building a culture of appreciation. That's a culture between the two of you where you talk constantly about, thank you for this. So I appreciate you doing that. I love you for this. This makes blah, 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 that kind of stuff. The third horseman was what he called defensiveness, which was the whole idea of perceiving that you're under attack all the time and that you can't do anything right and that you just kind of got to make sure that, you know, you're protecting yourself and it seems like that, you know, you can't even do that well. So the trick to that, the way to undo that or to make sure that stop happening is take responsibility for the circumstances and the situation and to own up to your part in it so that you step out from defending yourself and step into being real. And understanding that, you know, there are things, you're not perfect and that, you know, you can, things can be worked through. He said the fourth, final, and probably the most powerful of all of those horsemen was stonewalling. And that's, you know, the withdrawal. The thing that men are, you know, most likely to do is the thing that's most likely to bring their relationship undone. And the way to get around that is to find ways where you can kind of smooth out your emotions. So it doesn't matter which one of you is doing the stonewalling. You need the skills to be able to make yourself feel better. And, you know, that's doing things that bring warmth and joy into your life, because the more of that you do for you, then the less you want to stonewall, the more you want to open up, the greater heights the relationship will go to. So you'll see that this is kind of like responsibility on the right-hand side. That got us to, probably the second last break. Can't remember at this point. But we continued with, okay, how do you make deposits in the emotional bank account? Because really, this is the way to make relationships work. This is the kind of formula that most people should be given when they get married. They need to kind of like, you know, in fact, the Catholic Church runs classes for people who want to get married and says, we will not marry you until you come and do this course, and you have to successfully graduate from this course. And it's like a 3-month thing every Tuesday night or whatever. And what they discovered is 30% of the people who do that course decide to not get married. They decide to not proceed with the marriage. I would say that is an overwhelmingly positive thing. It could sound like bad news, you know, all these people who wanted to get married didn't. But if they decided that before they got married, how good is that they didn't have to go through all the dramas? So one of the things that we need to know is that there is a formula for making relationships work. And that formula pretty much boils down to these 5 things. And the first thing is dump the phone. The first thing is get in touch with your partner. Start paying attention to the emotional needs of your partner and understand that sometimes being ignored is not a question of malice. It's not a question of anything except I'm busy. Because if you start to focus and start to pay attention and be mindful of your partner's attempts to reach out to you and for you to turn towards them, that awareness is going to make the things start to feel warm and gentle, and both partners are going to start to feel like maybe they're feeling heard and maybe they're feeling valued and appreciated in the relationship. And, you know, you don't have to get it all. You don't have to catch every move your partner makes. But if you get into this overwhelmingly positive thing, then the positive outweighs the negative by such a huge margin that the relationship grows in depth and character. Number 2 out of the 5 keys in making relationships work is expressing appreciation in whatever is the way that you do that, but nevertheless doing that. At this point, we mentioned the 5 love languages. You should read that book. It's critically important you understand that your partner probably does not feel appreciated by the things you say or do, because it's unlikely that you do the things or say the things that make sense to your partner. If your partner is into words of appreciation and you give them a gift, the chances are they don't appreciate the gift, because I would rather have had the words. So make sure you understand your partner's love language and their preferences, so that you can make sure that your attempts at connection are being done in the language that's actually going to work. You can be doing things as simple as texting your partner and telling them that you've been thinking about them and hoping that things went well, or telling them that, you know, you were thinking about them, or getting the dishes washed, or do something that's unusual. Remember, it's remembering to make the positive deposits and express appreciations for the ones that are attempts in that direction by your partner as well. Third, and probably key, is talking about the stress that we are all under. Because the researchers are telling us that really the number one thing that breaks up relationships is not problems in the relationship, it's problems outside the relationship. In other words, lots of people split up because, or struggle with each other because of something happening elsewhere. For example, somebody struggling at work is under extra stress, and that can spill over into the relationship. Or somebody who's experiencing stress in the relationship can find that work doesn't go so well for them. So stress has this unique ability to move from one subject to another. What is the solution? Well, it's pretty simple. We recommend for all couples that there is a period of time at the end of the day where you go and give your partner undivided attention and validation. In other words, it's not a place for you to be fixing problems or to talking about what to do with bank accounts or any of that kind of stuff. It's a point where, a place where the two of you get to connect by talking about how was your day and relating to each other in terms of what they've been going through. What you have to do is kind of formalize that. So we've got some rules about that. We say there are 4 agreements and 6 rules. The agreements need to be, okay, when are you going to do that? Generally speaking, like I said, for most people, end of the day works better. But whereabouts and under what circumstances? Is there a time that you need that's going to work? Because if it's too short, it won't do any good at all. And if it's too long, the kids burn the house down. But then an agreement that you're not going to talk about each other or the situations in your life, like, you know, bank balances and situations and whatever. You're just going to connect with each other as human beings and talk about your day, and you're not going to judge each other, fix anything, or tell each other what they ought to be doing. You're just going to be accepting each other as they are. The rules mean you have to share that space. In other words, there's no point getting together and one of you monopolizing all of that. The other rule is that you have to show compassion to your partner about what they are going through. In my opinion, the most powerful words in relationship are, tell me more about that, because you're inviting your partner to share more of what it is that they're experiencing rather than less of it, or you tell them how it should be or whatever that is. Like we said over there in the agreements, this is a no solution situation. In other words, you're not there to fix each other. You're just there to be present to each other and to experience what it is that the other one is going through. That means validate your partner. In other words, get onto their team. Make sure that you back them, so to speak, rather than talking to them about how they should do it different or feel different or whatever that is. So validate your partner, saying, and come together. Understand that most teams are actually best when they are us against them rather than, yeah, well, I reckon your boss is right. You should do more of this and less of that and whatever. And be affectionate. There's nothing wrong with holding hands, touching, reassurance, cuddling, all that sort of stuff to signify connection. Critically important. Number 5, communication is really about, is really about understanding. You know, we can talk about communication till we're blue in the face, but really understand that when your partner is talking, they are not wanting you to fix things mostly. They're wanting you to identify with the problem and to see what it is that they are feeling. So Stephen Covey's got this expression, seek first to understand, then to be understood. It's the fastest way to get through something. Take responsibility if you should, but understand that communication is really all about willingness. You know, when we see people who meet each other that don't even speak the same language, you know, one of them speaks French, the other speaks English, those people can still communicate. Those people can still fall in love, get together, and not be able to speak the other person's language, because communication is much more than language. In fact, in my opinion, communication is all summarized in the word willingness. And if you're willing to communicate, you'll find a way. If you're unwilling to communicate, you will find a way to not communicate regardless of what's going on. What that means is be affectionate, or it should lead to being affectionate. So it's important that you kiss and you cuddle and you hold hands and you take opportunities to make deposits in the emotional bank account. Researchers are telling us that your physical health, the indicators, the biomarkers will go through the roof as a consequence of a strong physical connection between the two of you. Therefore, physical affection is a critically important thing, but you've got to understand your partner's language for that as well. Otherwise, it doesn't look like it's all working out. In summary, what we're saying is you have to know about your hidden agenda, the one that you brought into the relationship, and you have to take care of the baggage that you brought with you. Otherwise, things are going to be ugly. You have to learn how to meet your own emotional needs, because if you don't, then you're acting as if you're a vessel that needs to be filled by your partner. And if that's the case, your partner's just going to feel like they've got another job to do. We need to learn to be straight and to be compassionate and to share the truth without hurting and without seeking to hurt. In fact, seeking to do the opposite. We need to take our share of responsibility for things that are going right and wrong in the relationship. You need to recognize when your partner is flooded and do whatever you need to do to help them get unflooded. But long term, you need to start investing in the emotional bank account. The more you do, the more you will feel like you are in control of the relationship, because you feel like you are contributing to it rather than it running you. And if you don't recognize and stop the four horsemen, then they get to run the whole show. And then we just talked recently about debriefing every day as a way of staying connected. And what we need to do is spend our time figuring out how do we create opportunities to surprise and delight and get our partner to be in awe of how lucky they are to be with us. That's critically important. That's our job. I then recommended the worksheets, the assessments, and we talked about what's next, which is this session tonight, and then our next workshop being resilience, which looks like still being under lockdown, so it'll be a Zoom meeting. So the venue for that's going to be your house, same as it was for this one. And we called it a day at that point. From here, I just want to remind you about the existence of a Facebook group. We want you to connect with that, get into there, post in there as much as you want or as little as you want. And that way that allows me to do some coaching and to be with you on the journey as much as is possible. We'd love to do that. Right now, I've got a bit of time for questions and answers. I'm stunned that we got through that in the hour that we did. Let me bring up my thing and just ask if there are any questions. I'll just quickly remind you that to ask a question, all you got to do is put your hand up. There's a little icon in your control panel, and a little blue hand will show up, and I will acknowledge you, and then you can ask whatever you want, and we'll go from there. So over to you guys in terms of questions, thoughts, comments, ideas, anything along those lines. Okay, let's assume that we have either done a terrible job or a great one, and that it must be a great one on account of this is second time around. So thanks for being with us, gang. Hopefully you got a heap out of that. I certainly learnt a lot by going through it that quick. Hopefully you did too. We look forward to seeing you at the next Elite Get-Together. Good night. God bless.
Night, Paul.